This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with an expert on climate change to better understand the latest UN report on climate change and the true crisis that we now face.
We speak with law professor Eleanor Stein. She knows what she's talking about. Don't despair. Listen in. There's stuff we can do.
Also on Law and Disorder today, we talk with an environmental justice attorney about a Cancer Alley case.
Cancer Alley is that strip in Louisiana populated by black people, former slaves, who are getting sick and killed by the corporate pollution down there.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The new flagship United Nations report on climate change shows that harmful carbon emissions have never been higher in human history, and that this is proof that the world is on a fast track to disaster, with scientists arguing that it's now or never to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. Indeed, the report's scientists claim that at the dismal rate matters to address climate change are now going, the world has but 10 years until catastrophic climate change is irreversible. Or as the UN's General Secretary Guterres puts it, the planet is now nearing the point of no return. Yes, in a Washington Post op-ed article, Guterres described the latest IPCC report as a litany of broken promises which revealed what he called a yawning gap between climate pledges and reality. Indeed, the reality is that despite ever-increasing awareness of the consequences of climate change and the central role that humans play in causing it given our continued use of fossil fuels, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions released into the atmosphere every year actually continue to rise every year, and are each year greater than the prior year. For as Guterres wrote, corporations and high-emitting governments have not simply, well, turned a blind eye to the problem. They are, in his words, adding fuel to the flames by continuing to invest in climate-choking industries. Already millions of the world's people have been displaced by climate change, and the world now experiences a greater and greater increase in severe storms, unprecedented heat waves, widespread water shortages, and the extinction of millions of species of plants and animals. Well, we and you, our listeners, are fortunate because our guest for this topic today is attorney Eleanor Stein. Ms. Stein is a professor of law who began teaching climate change in 2005 at Albany Law School, and who now teaches climate change and human rights law at the State University of New York. A climate justice activist and advocate, Eleanor has published and spoken extensively on these issues, most recently in chapters and books on crisis lawyering and energy democracy, and articles in The Radical Teacher and the McGill Environmental Law Journal. Well, Professor Eleanor Stein, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure being here and getting to talk about this topic with you.
Thank you, thank you. Eleanor, in my introduction, I pointed out that the scientists involved in the latest UN climate report, as well as the Secretary General of the United Nations, now speak of time running out. They speak of the world having no more really than 10 years to avoid an irreversible climate disaster. They talk about greenhouse gas emissions increasing every year rather than decreasing. Now, prior reports from the United Nations on climate change have certainly been alarming, but none, it seems to me, as much as this one. Are they correct in their dismal and truly alarming assessment of where the battle to contain climate change now stands?
Yes, of course they're correct. This is the work of thousands of climate scientists all over the world, and the report is vetted and approved by basically every country in the world, pretty much. And they take years to do these reports. They come out every 5 or 6 years. In this report, they use the phrase, there's a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. And they're talking about when we hit a point where the average global temperature is between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius, and in above pre-industrial levels of global temperature. And to us, that doesn't sound like a very big change. I mean, in an average day in New York, you like today, you woke up, it was like 40 degrees. It'll probably be 55 degrees by the end of the day. We don't think anything of it. But you have to remember, this is global temperature, and it's Celsius. And the last ice age, which ended about 12,000 years ago, there was a one-mile-thick glacier covering most of New York State, and the global temperature was only 6 degrees colder than it is today. So a very small number can make an enormous difference in terms of the conditions under which we live and people live and all species live. So, but I would just point out that the report is not only dismal and terrifying. It also includes very strong references to the specific measures and markers that have to be taken immediately. And all of these measures are things that are in our hands. We're talking about existing technologies. We're talking about not only a more equitable, but a more economical way of living. And if we can get off fossil fuels and do it in a way that's equitable, we could make these changes and prevent these very terrible consequences.
Eleanor, I believe that this is the first time that the UN report on climate change has linked the climate crisis to both old and continuing colonialism. Are they right to do so?
Well, of course they are. Yes, absolutely. I think it's a very important marker because from the very beginning, their reports and the international climate framework has included the assumption that all countries have some responsibilities, but they are different responsibilities based on countries' capacity, poverty level, wealth level, and so on, level of development. So they talk about shared but different responsibilities. But here, they recognize that there's a contradiction between the rich and the poor countries. But here, for the first time, when they use the word colonialism and historical and ongoing patterns of inequity, I think they are flagging the fact that the wealth of part of the world is dependent and based on the poverty in other parts of the world. And, of course, the same thing is true within wealthy nations, right, like our own. So it's not just that there are wealthy countries and poor countries, but that the relationship between these two is a cause and effect relationship, and that unless we can break that relationship, we will have a very hard time solving the climate problem.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor Stein, the UN Secretary General Guterres, in an op-ed piece he wrote in the Washington Post, wrote of how high-emitting governments and corporations were not just turning a blind eye to the problem, they were adding fuel to the flames by continuing to invest in climate-choking industries. And this, in turn, well, it reaffirms my long-held belief that it is capitalism, be it so-called democratic capitalism or authoritarian capitalism, that has brought about the climate crisis in the first place, and that so long as capitalist economic systems continue to, well, dominate the world, we're never going to halt climate change before that catastrophe that the UN scientists talk about has become deadly real. Do you agree?
You know, I agree and disagree. There's no question that high-emitting governments and corporations, particularly what we call the fossil majors, the major fossil fuel corporations in the world, which are among the world's largest and include the largest corporations in the world, have the responsibility for this at their door and continue to invest and government to protect and invest in these fossil fuel corporations. And we saw this most clearly looking at the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which led to shortages of natural gas and, of course, boycotts of Russian natural gas by many European countries. And as a result, we had very serious price spikes in gas, which were, you know, caused by withholding the product. And the fossil majors earned more than $40 billion in just 1 year and super profits from that situation. So certainly capitalism, we could call it racial capitalism. I like to think of it as extractive capitalism. Climate change is kind of the ultimate product of the imperialist capitalist system globally. However, no country with any economic system that I know of, perhaps the exception of Cuba, has really gotten it right in terms of climate. And in my view, we cannot afford the belief that climate change cannot be halted as long as capitalist systems dominate. Current economic systems can and must decarbonize. It's not complicated. They will save money. There's even profit to be made. There's tremendous health benefits as well as carbon reduction. And, we have the technology and we have price advantages to get off oil, natural gas, and coal globally, and especially in the wealthy countries. So I'm not willing to quite, I think we have to demand that our current governments and our current corporations do this with all the tools that we have. Elections, marching in the street, withdrawing investments from banks that invest in fossil fuel and from fossil fuel corporations. There's a lot of tactics and measures that we haven't even begun to do to make our government change its path. And when people have done that, we have made real gains.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host and former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with climate law professor Eleanor Stein. Eleanor, on a more positive note, I understand that there have been some new and hopeful legal rulings. Is this the case? And if so, please talk about some of these.
Sure, I'd be glad to. There have been quite a few. The field that I've been working in recently is the field of human rights and, to some extent, constitutional rights and climate change. And these two different, legal frameworks have seldom been put together, but now they are definitely coming together. So there was a breakthrough decision out of the federal court in Oregon in 2016 in a case called Juliana versus the United States, where a group of young people wanted to hold the U.S. government responsible for the impacts on the Oregon climate that were affecting their lives and their families' lives. And they brought the case on constitutional grounds and also human rights grounds on a claim of what they called intergenerational justice, that we can hold countries, hold corporations responsible for placing a greater burden on future generations by failing to do what we must do today. We're just kicking the can down the road, and they are developing this theory that there's a constitutional and human rights basis to prevent that, and from courts to prevent that. And there's currently a case. So the Juliana case was overturned in part on appeal, and it's now in a process of negotiations. But there's a case out of Montana, Held versus the state of Montana, is actually going to trial in June. That'll be the first time climate change has been actually the subject of a full trial in the United States. But I'll just add that internationally there have been many, many cases where governments have actually been forced by the courts to take more aggressive action on climate change in response to lawsuits by their citizens. There are some real landmark cases from the Netherlands, including one holding not only the government but Royal Dutch Shell, one of the fossil majors, responsible and ordering them to reduce their emissions. There's cases from Germany, from France, from Australia, and many other places, either on intergenerational equity or similar grounds, say, using different human rights instruments to show that climate change is a violation of human rights. And I'll just add one other thing, which is that just last week, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution to request the International Criminal Court issue a declaratory ruling on the human rights to a livable climate and state responsibility. And if they do that, and if it's a good ruling, that could really move this jurisprudence forward very quickly.
Well, tell me this, Eleanor. Many governments, when talking about climate change, you know, often place heavy emphasis on what we as individuals can and should do, you know, recycle, buy electric cars, stop using our air conditioners, and the like. And certainly those suggestions, if followed, would be of help. But I've been led to believe that simply taking those measures won't be enough to save the day, that the industrialized world has got to make drastic changes in its manufacturing and production methods if the climate crisis is ever to really be solved. But what do you think? What do you believe? What are your solutions to this essential crisis brought about by changing climate?
Well, I would suggest that the most important thing that individuals can do is to put pressure in any way they can on our government and on the fossil majors to decarbonize and get out in the street. There's Third Act, which is Bill McKibben's current organization, urging people to take out their investments from banks that invest in fossil fuels, and there's many, many, many other groups doing this. But it's also true, and the IPCC report notes that the 10% of households globally with the highest per capita emissions contribute almost 45% of global household-based emissions, and the bottom 50% contribute 13 to 15%. So those of us in comparatively wealthy countries with comparatively comfortable standards of living, our emissions actually constitute a significant portion of the world's emissions. So I do think we also have some personal responsibility to look at the carbon footprint of our own lives and households and what that amounts to.
Indeed. Thank you.
Eleanor, how do you see the changes you've just recommended coming about? A change of heart on the part of the capitalists and corporations that currently produce or manufacture most of the world's goods? Or will it require a people-driven, kind of a revolutionary movement that leaves those responsible for the crisis scrambling to finally change their deadly ways?
Well, I don't think we're going to get a spontaneous change of heart on the part of the corporations and the capitalists. But that doesn't mean that our political pressure and pressure that we can put on them in every way through our movements cannot force very significant changes. And have already forced significant changes, but can force really significant changes. There's a lot of greenwashing. Many of the fossil majors and other fossil fuel corporations, you know, have good public relations measures and strategies to convince us consumers and convince government that they're doing their share. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Their strategy, very clearly, and this year has been a really clear example of it, is to make sure that every drop of oil, every molecule of natural gas that can be extracted will be mined, will be found, and will be sold, and will be burned as fast as possible. That is their strategy. And we have to do everything we can to prevent that. And I think there's many ways for us to put pressure, even on the current system. And, of course, a systemic change would be the best. But even in that context, we have to make sure that these values and environmental values are part and parcel of any movement that we're doing. And I think those of us who are working on all the many issues that we do today for justice, for equality, and for freedom in so many ways, we should all try to include consciousness and demands related to the climate crisis and link them in to the other work that we're doing to make sure it's part of our collective program in terms of opposition and in terms of the kind of future that we want to build.
Be hard to disagree with that. I was just thinking as you were talking, Noam Chomsky talking about the two gravest crises facing us, of course, are some sort of nuclear meltdowns and climate change. So your points are well taken on that, and we thank you so much. I wonder, Eleanor, how can our listeners learn more about this issue and in particular find your writings on this critically important matter?
Well, I did give you a list of my favorite current books, articles, and also websites from organizations like the Harlem-based We Act for Environmental Justice, We Act, UPROSE, United Puerto Ricans of Sunset Park, New York City Environmental Justice Alliance. These groups keep us posted day-to-day on important developments. And also the New York Times has one of its newsletters on climate, has really excellent coverage on global climate issues.
Yes.
So those are these are the current places that I would really recommend that people look. If you want to read my writings, I have writings in Radical Teacher and in the McGill Environmental Law Journal and several other places. But in terms of keeping up to date, these are the, you know, these websites will give you the best.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. You're our go-to person on climate change. We'll get back to you, and we hope that the next time we speak with you, you've got encouraging news.
Well, and thank you for your work in this area, too. I so appreciate it. Nothing is much more critical. And thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder, Eleanor.
It's been a pleasure. And keep your eyes on those pending lawsuits, the Montana one in June. Keep your eyes on that. Very good. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
To St. James Infirmary. Saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so sweet, so fair. Let her go, let her go. God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over, but she'll never find a sweet man like me.
Bragging.
When I die, bury me in straight-laced shoes. I want a box bag coat and a Stetson hat.
John B., that is.
Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain so the boys will know that I died standing back.
Cancer Alley. It is the 135-mile-long strip along both sides of the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and south down to New Orleans. In an environmental racism case, three Louisiana organizations sued on March 21st in federal district court in New Orleans against the Parish Council of St. James Parish. A parish is a county in New Orleans, and the Parish Council is their government. The predominantly white parish council granted a permit for a company to build a $9 billion petrochemical plant to make plastics. The plant is expected to spew 6,000 tons a year of cancer-causing chemicals into the atmosphere. The lawsuit seeks to protect black neighborhoods and is asking for a moratorium on the building of more hazardous petrochemical plants where people live and breathe and where black people are getting sick and dying in disproportionate numbers. We speak today with attorney Asa Sharma Pakharel of the Center for Constitutional Rights. There she specializes in international human rights law and in challenging racial and environmental injustice. In the Cancer Alley lawsuit, she represents the Mount Trump Baptist Church and Inclusive Indiana. A project of the Tulane Law School represents Rise St. James. These are the three black neighborhood organizations that are plaintiffs in the suit. Attorney Asa Sharma Pakharel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show. It's really great to be here.
Asa, you've been down to Cancer Alley. What's it like? At the press conference announcing your lawsuit, one of the residents said that when she walks out the door, there's smoke in the air, and she's looking forward to the day that she can breathe free. Gail LaBeouf, another plaintiff, has an extremely violent form of cancer. Please talk about your clients, the organizations that they're in, the ones that you're representing, and the various illnesses people get from living in this kind of pollution.
There are three plaintiffs in this lawsuit. That's Inclusive Louisiana, Mount Triumph Baptist Church, and Rise St. James. Those are the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, and our clients, the Center for Constitutional Rights, whose clients are Inclusive Louisiana and Mount Triumph Baptist Church. And Rise St. James is represented by the Tulane Environmental Law Clinic. So for background, like you all have described, you know, St. James Parish is in a county in Cancer Alley, which is an area of the country that historically was characterized by deadly sugarcane plantations where people were enslaved. And today those plantations have been turned into heavy industrial facilities, mostly petrochemical facilities, but not only that. Inclusive Louisiana and Rise St. James, you know, you asked about our clients. Inclusive Louisiana and Rise St. James are both grassroots community-based organizations that are based in St. James Parish. They're made up of individuals who've lived in St. James Parish all of their lives. Many of their members are descendants of people who were once enslaved in the area, and they live in the majority black 4th and 5th districts in the parish, where they're exposed to high levels of pollution and toxins because of these heavy industrial facilities. And the other plaintiff, Mount Triumph Baptist Church, is a church that was founded in 1904. So it has existed for almost 120 years, and it's surrounded by petrochemical facilities. I mean, if you look at aerial imagery of the church and what surrounds it, it's really shocking to see how these facilities are really encircling this church. So there's about 24 heavy industrial facilities currently constructed in St. James Parish that was counted. And about 20 of those are in the 4th and 5th districts, which, like I said, are majority black. And all of the ones that have been permitted but are pending construction are also in the 4th and 5th districts. And not a single heavy industrial facility has been permitted outside of the 4th and 5th districts, so in majority white parts of the parish, in 46 years. And like we describe in our complaint, all of our clients have lost loved ones to cancer. As you said, Ms. Gail LaBeouf has been diagnosed with cancer. Ms. Barbara Washington, who's also a founding member of Inclusive Louisiana, has said that she knows at least 50 people who've died of cancer, including her sister. You know, you can read in our complaint that we describe the various illnesses that are the result of the pollution emitted by these facilities. It's not just cancer, but other forms of respiratory and cardiovascular disease, impacts to the nervous system, to the liver. And so these health and life impacts are one set of impacts that are the result of these facilities, but there's also another set of impacts that has to do with our clients' history and their cultural origins and religion. And you know, our clients have worked really hard. Our clients who are descendants of those enslaved in plantations in Cancer Alley have worked really hard to reveal, you know, that those who were enslaved in these plantations, who died in these plantations, were buried in unmarked cemeteries within these plantations. So our clients have ancestors buried in the areas that now have been turned into heavy industrial facilities or have been set aside for that. So just to say that, you know, the health and life impacts of these facilities are huge, and there's just
a range of other impacts that our clients have experienced and felt.
Indeed. I wonder, Asta, to be a little more specific, St. James Parish is in, we're talking about what state when we talk about St. James Parish here?
We're talking about Louisiana.
That's what I thought. Yeah, Louisiana. And you mentioned Cancer Alley. Does that include, does that Cancer Alley run through other states as well?
So Cancer Alley is the part of Louisiana that stretches between New Orleans and Baton Rouge that's within Louisiana.
All right. And it's clear that this is largely black neighborhoods that we're talking about that are being governed. And they're being governed by the St. James Parish Council. But my understanding is that that local government, that council, is made up, well, mostly of white folks. What is their record so far of protecting the black citizens and the residents that they govern?
That's right. So it's true that the council is mostly white, though it's not all white. It's not 100% white. And as you'll read in our complaint, their record has not been very good. So just taking a step back and thinking about responsibility, about the parish's responsibility, the Parish Planning Commission and Council today have the authority under the law to permit or deny industrial facilities in the parish. So they have the authority to say yes to a company that wants to build a facility or to say no. So they are the ones with the primary authority to do that. And stepping even further back in terms of responsibility, the parish, which is, I think I mentioned sort of like the county, the way in which counties are referred to in Louisiana, the parish has the primary responsibility over zoning, over land use, and over historic preservation in the parish. The parish government has that primary responsibility. So I think, you know, the parish government, including the parish council's record, reveals sort of the failure to recognize the history of slavery that characterizes this area, and a commitment or sort of an effort to compound that history, to worsen the impact of that history and the harms of slavery by locating more death-making facilities in areas of the parish that are predominantly black. So the 4th and 5th districts in the parish. And this lawsuit is really an attempt by our clients to expose that record and to give the parish yet another opportunity to make amends.
The 13th Amendment was passed at the time of the Civil War a century and a half ago. It abolished slavery. Its companion, the 14th Amendment, gave all people in the United States the right to vote, and all people in the United States, black and white, should be treated equally. Your main claim is that the St. James Parish land use system violated the 13th Amendment as a vestige of slavery, as well as the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, which bars discrimination. How can you prove this against the St. James Parish District Council?
That's a really good question. So I'll begin with the 13th Amendment. So that's right that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. It was also intended to abolish the badges and incidents of slavery, so the vestiges of slavery. You know, there's little jurisprudence on the 13th Amendment, so we'll have to see how a court chooses to analyze the land use system and St. James Parish and how it chooses to analyze whether this land use system that exists today is a badge or incident of slavery. But of course, in our complaint, we're describing how it clearly is, how the heavy industrial facilities that exist in St. James today are on the site of former sugarcane plantations where people were enslaved. And those people, you know, once freed, they settled in communities in St. James Parish nearby, outside of the plantations, but nearby, in communities like Welcome in the parish, Freetown, Romeville. And so these industrial plants in the parish that the parish, including the parish council, has permitted, these plants are on the site of former plantations, and they have deadly impacts on the surrounding community's health and lives. And they impact their ability to practice religion and commune with their ancestors who are buried in these plantations. So the parish, by permitting these facilities, has replaced one deadly and death-making institution, so slavery, with another, and that's heavy industry. you asked about the 14th Amendment claim, the equal protection claim. That's also right. So the complaint raises a 14th Amendment claim, which is that the land use system is racially discriminatory in violation of the Equal Protection Clause because it cites industry in predominantly black parts of the parish while protecting white parts of the parish from industry. There's also a few other claims that I want to uplift that our clients are bringing. One is under the 14th Amendment, which also protects individuals' right to bodily integrity. So our claim is that this land use policy and practice is lethal and, of course, negatively impacts our clients' bodily integrity. We also raised some claims under the federal law that protects religious land use. So we describe, you know, like I mentioned, how there's cemeteries of people once enslaved throughout the parish in these former plantations. And what has happened is that the parish, instead of protecting these cemeteries, has allowed for the construction of heavy industry upon these cemeteries. We also describe sort of a religious discrimination and how the parish has protected Catholic churches, which are majority white in Louisiana, but has left without protection black and Baptist churches in majority black parts of the parish. And then finally, just my last point is that our clients, we also raise a claim under the Louisiana Constitution, which protects the right of people to preserve their historic and cultural origins.
Well, Asa, isn't it also the case, though, that it's not enough in your case to simply establish that a bad situation exists? You have to show, as I understand it, that the government intended for that to be the case. Isn't that a rather difficult task in the Fifth Circuit, which is, well, made up of rather reactionary judges? So talk to us about that, and also tell us about the specific relief that your lawsuit seeks.
Thank you. Yeah, the question of intent is a really good one. I think you're right that for those claims where we have to show intent, the equal protection claim, for example, the law has set what I think, you know, is an unfairly high burden on plaintiffs. But you'll see in our complaint that we set out extensive facts to meet that burden. So you have, for example, the parish council passing a land use plan in 2014 that creates buffer zones around certain structures in the parish and not others. And these buffer zones protect these structures from industrial development. So, for example, it creates 2-mile buffer zones around tourist plantations and around Catholic churches, which are majority white. Like I said, they're majority white in Louisiana, and around some schools, but it does not apply those same buffer zones to black Baptist churches and to schools in the majority black parts of the parish. And so we've counted at least 12 churches and schools serving black communities in the 4th and 5th district of the parish that are left out of these buffer zones that instead protect majority white parts of the parish and structures and institutions that are important to white communities in the parish. You also have, you know, the land use plan, the 2014 land use plan, designating certain tracts of land in the parish as industrial or future industrial. And those categories are only applied to tracts of land that, again, are in majority black parts of the parish, which the parish council obviously knows are majority black and knows have residents in these areas, right? So what these designations demonstrate is an intention on the part of the parish to end the residential nature of these communities. And this is why we say in our complaint that this is a racial cleansing plan, because the parish knows that the residents in these areas are majority black, and yet it intends to transform those areas from residential to industrial. And then you have other factors that show discriminatory intent too. You know, like I said earlier, permitting facilities in black parts of the parish, rejecting them in white parts of the parish, a history of racism in the parish. And then you also have instances in which the parish council and the parish government has deviated from normal procedure to allow facilities in black parts of the parish. So this deviation from kind of legal procedure is also evidence of discrimination, of discriminatory intent. And I wanted to just go back to something you said about being in the Fifth Circuit, which You know, the truth is that Louisiana, the Eastern District of Louisiana, the Fifth Circuit, this is where our clients live. This is where their lives are, and this is where the harm is occurring. It's just the reality of what they're facing. We can't sort of change the history and the truth of the location of these harms, the location of sort of the history and ongoing racism that's characterized Louisiana and St. James Parish. And so it's a bit inevitable that we are where we are, right?
Of course.
In the sense that we are in the Fifth Circuit. And so I think what's valuable about being in the circuit that we're in is that it's also an opportunity for courts in this circuit and for district courts and other courts to sort of right past wrongs. This is an opportunity, right? So that's my thought on being in the Fifth Circuit. And then I think the last part of your question was about relief asking for. So, you know, our clients are not asking for damages or monetary relief. They're only seeking injunctive and declaratory relief. So some of the things that our clients are asking for is for a court order of a permanent moratorium on all new facilities in the parish. So a moratorium on the permitting of all new facilities in the parish, particularly in the 4th and 5th District where they live. Our clients are seeking an order from the court that requiring the parish to protect burial sites of people once enslaved in the parish, so to protect these unmarked cemeteries. And our clients are seeking a court order for a court-monitored process involving directly affected communities to help guide sort of the transformation in the parish, to reimagine what the economy of the parish should look like. And then, of course, they're seeking declaratory relief in the form of the court stating or ordering that the parish's actions are a violation of constitution and federal law.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host and former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Asa Sharma Pakarel from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's litigating an environmental justice case down in Louisiana having to do with what they call Cancer Alley. Asa, you've said that the lawsuit is the first of its kind in the way it uses the civil rights statutes and the Constitution. How do you link the harms that persist today in St. James Parish to slavery and its afterlife? In other words, how is environmental injustice a vestige of slavery?
Thank you so much. You know, it's a really good question. You'll see in our complaint how we describe the history of colonization and dispossession in Louisiana in general in the first part of our complaint. And then how we describe the history of slavery, particularly in St. James Parish, how the plantations that existed then have now been turned into petrochemical facilities, impacting the Black communities in the parish who are descendants of those once enslaved there. So this area of Louisiana that we're talking about, St. James Parish, was historically the site of a deadly sugarcane plantation industry. And if you look at kind of aerial imagery today, so if you go on Google Earth or Google Maps and look at aerial imagery, you'll see that the parcels of land that kind of correspond to industrial facilities or these plants look like what plantations looked like back in the day. So even visually, you see this continuum between slavery and the sugarcane plantation industry and what is going on today, and that's just kind of visually, right? So and so historically, these sugarcane plantations were characterized by an extremely high mortality rate among those who were enslaved. So an economy where the lives of Black people was considered disposable, where it was characterized by premature mortality and, of course, like, subordination and torture. And like I mentioned earlier, one thing to note also is that our clients have worked so hard to reveal that those who died on these plantations, that the people who were enslaved on these plantations and died there, were not usually buried in cemeteries outside of the plantation. They were usually buried inside of the plantation where they were enslaved, within the site of their oppression. And so what is heavy industry today is it's not only that it's on former plantations, but it's also on the unmarked cemeteries of people that were once enslaved there. And so in our complaint, we describe how these properties, the plantation properties owned by slave owners historically, has remained in the hands of white people in the parish, including descendants of those slave owners, and so has political power. So through efforts to disenfranchise the black population of the state, political power has also remained in the hands of white people in the parish. And so beginning in the 1950s, when heavy industrial facilities, mostly petrochemical facilities, but not limited to petrochemical, when they began coming into these parishes, it was facilitated by the political leadership, which again, political power, you know, was maintained in the hands of white people. And who benefited from this? White landowners who had retained control over these large parcels of land that were formerly sugarcane plantations. And in 2014, this pattern and practice was solidified and consolidated and made explicit into this land use plan, this land use ordinance that exists today. So that's kind of who the political that's about the political leadership that has facilitated this, and the people who have benefited from this. And then conversely, the question is who is negatively impacted by it. And the answer is that those who are negatively impacted by it are descendants of people who were once enslaved in these plantations. People who, once they were freed, they settled and created lives for themselves outside the plantation, but nearby where they could. And it's those descendant communities that are now facing the deadly health and other impacts of the industry. And I want to just give one quick example of the Mosaic Uncle Sam property. So in the 1960s, the Freeport Sulphur Company met with the parish police jury president, so the precursor to the parish council. So the president at the time was Francis Wagaspak. The company met with the president to discuss a plan that it wanted to build in Convent. And Wagaspak's family had operated a number of sugarcane farms in the area, including those that they had purchased just after the Civil War. And the company, so Freeport, ended up locating on the former Uncle Sam plantation. Like I said, this is in Convent, which is a predominantly black community, and it's close to the historically black community of Romeville, which is a community settled by freed people just after emancipation. And today that facility is owned by Mosaic, a fertilizer company, and it has a massive radioactive waste lake on its property. And it's located just 1 mile from our clients, Mount Triumph Baptist Church, and about 2 miles from Miss Barbara Washington and Miss Myrtle Felton, who are founding members of Inclusive. And just earlier this month, I think it was last month, Mosaic Uncle Sam announced plans that it wants to expand. So you see this continuum from slavery of both the retention of control over land and the retention of control over political power by white people in the parish, including descendants of slave owners. And the result has been a land use pattern and practice that has resulted in deadly impacts on predominantly black communities in the parish.
Indeed. Well, it's an extraordinary lawsuit and an extraordinary factual situation. It reminds me that that attorney Michael Ratner, who, of course, was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, brought a number of lawsuits that were not won, but were nevertheless successful in educating people and in mobilizing people. He called this success without victory. We certainly hope your case is successful, but what kind of organizing is going on amongst the black folks of this particular parish and their allies in Cancer Alley? Cancer Alley itself, which is dotted with more than 200 industrial facilities, including oil refineries, plastic plants, my goodness, chemical plants, factories that emit significant amounts of harmful air pollution. So with respect to the lawsuit, aside from what will happen in court, has it so far served to both educate and help to mobilize the community itself, which may well have been mobilized before the suit, but it's, what has its role been in that regard?
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing Michael Ratner into this conversation. So I guess, you know, I'll just say that there's so much amazing organizing going on. There's such a wide range of groups, from faith-based groups like some of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit to churches, to scientists, to genealogists. And I think there's such a wide range because there's so much at stake here, right? So much history, so many aspects of our clients' lives that are impacted, and there's so many different people that are needed to be a part of this fight. And I think, importantly, there's so much history in Louisiana and St. James Parish, so much history that this particular land use pattern and practice reveals, the history of colonization and dispossession, of slavery, of the promise of Reconstruction, and then Jim Crow until today. And our clients have been working for years now to both change this fact, this reality, but also to engage in education about the history of the parish. And so we really hope that this lawsuit continues doing some of that work of political education and education of the history in the parish.
Unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time, and we're going to have to say goodbye. But before we do that, can you tell us briefly how our listeners can follow the progress of this lawsuit and get in touch with the CCR and follow their work?
Yes, of course. So there's a website that I'd like to share with your listeners. That's imaginestjamesparish.org. So it's imaginestjamesparish.org. And you can see there, you'll be able to see how you can follow the lawsuit and support our clients' efforts. You can also follow our clients on their social media. So Inclusive Louisiana has a Facebook page. Rise St. James does too. They have a Facebook and Instagram page. And then you can also read about the complaint at ccrjustice.org. That's ccrjustice.org.
Wonderful.
Well, great, Asa. Thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. We'll check back in with you, and we hope we can announce a victory. You take it easy.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.